So, welcome back to this second day where we're reflecting on the seven treasures, the seven limbs of awakening. Yesterday, we had a goodly amount of time to kind of give an overview of these seven qualities or these seven limbs that incline the mind towards awakening. And I think really spend some time at looking the significant place that they occupy in the Buddhist teaching, and that these are, of course, as we mentioned yesterday, really seeds of potentiality already present within us, to be cultivated, to be brought into being. In many ways, this morning, I'd like to just begin with a slight sideline around this word cultivation. The Pali word for this is bhavana, which means to bring into being or to cultivate. Now, we tend to rather translate this as meditation, which is a very small part of bhavana. But bhavana really encourages us to cultivate that which is lovely, to cultivate that which is healing, to cultivate that which is liberating. And I do feel for many Westerners in practice, this is for many quite a radical reorientation in how they approach their meditative pathways. I think in culturally, you know, we are so trained to have such a successful work ethic. And when you combine that ingrained work ethic with what in psychology is called negative attentional bias, which tends to focus and highlight what is wrong and imperfect and flawed over that which is well. So it's giving far more weight in our perceptions to that which is broken rather than that which is well. And when you get this combination of this work ethic and negative attentional bias, for many people, they find themselves, or certainly they tell me they find themselves, approaching their path as, you know, again, an opportunity to work on the difficult. To work on what is wrong, to work on what is broken. And I think sometimes there's a hidden hope in there that if we successfully do that, we will be rewarded with lovely qualities such as peacefulness and happiness and joyfulness and understanding. In the early texts, quite frankly, I have not found anything to support this view at all. When you read the early text, certainly there is a very clear recognition, you know, of the patterns and the conditioning that creates distress. But the Buddha's response to this, in my reading, seems to be one of cultivation. That we don't work on the difficult, that we cultivate that which leads to understanding. We cultivate the healing, we cultivate the liberating, we cultivate the conditions inwardly that incline the mind towards wakefulness. And in that cultivation, or it is that cultivation that actually has the effect of unbinding us from that which is difficult. So the priority is given not to what is broken and working on it. The priority is given to what is possible for us as human beings. And I think for many people, that reorientation is something of a leap of trust. It's almost like a leap of faith to really trust that that cultivation and that approach is actually going to do the unbinding that we seek for. And if you'll notice, I use the word unbinding very specifically. This is the word that the Buddha uses over and over, unbinding. We tend to use the word, the phrase letting go, which is, I think, a direct path to getting us into trouble. I don't know how successful any of you have been in shouting at yourself to let go of something. I know it's never been particularly successful in my own life. And it also raises the questions of, who is doing the letting go? Who possesses that agency, as if somewhere hiding within us, there's a very wise little self that's going to step out at the right moment and do this act of letting go of something. So I would encourage you again to just reframe a little bit and think of the difference between unbinding and letting go. And what is it that unbinds the heart, the mind, from that which leads to distress and to compounding distress? So yesterday we spent time having an overview of these seven treasures, and we particularly focused more specifically on the first two of mindfulness and investigation. I hope you remember that. And it's often said that investigation, it looks backwards to mindfulness, of course, because mindfulness has the effect of illuminating what is present, illuminating the world both inwardly and outwardly. And in that illuminating of our experience, we can begin to see more clearly what is going on, how our world of experience is being constructed, and we can begin to investigate. So investigation looks backwards to mindfulness, but then it also looks forward to this next quality, which in Pali is called virya. Now, again, it's quite difficult to find one English word that really captures what is meant by virya. So again, it's one of these very nuanced words in Pali. Sometimes it's translated as appropriate or attuned effort. It's translated as courage or fearlessness. I think the most, what I understand, the most exact translation of virya is one who possesses a strong arm. So it has this connotation of courage, of fearlessness, as willingness and dedication. But virya also has elements within it of forbearance and responsiveness. It is the energetic factor in skillful effort. It also holds within it a sense, a quality of inspiration and enthusiasm. It has a sense of passion within it. As it draws upon investigation, it says it looks forward and inclines the heart towards joyfulness. So yesterday I mentioned the Satipatthana discourse, which of course many of you are familiar with, the kind of core teaching of establishing mindfulness in the early text. And there's a refrain that recurs frequent, well, in every passage through the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha speaks of a practitioner contemplating their present moment experience, ardent, fully aware, and mindful. And we think about this word ardency that I think many people would associate with passion and with love, a passionate interest. So the Buddha's encouragement is not towards having a kind of tepid or lukewarm response about waking up. There's another word from the Pali that I think describes this ardency, which is samvega, or a spiritual urgency. A spiritual urgency, the deep longing to be awake that guides our speech, our thoughts, and our actions. A passion that is not diverted or distracted, that is cultivated in the midst of the veiling factors. And I think it's useful to reflect on how this relates to investigation and what investigation of our lives and our experience actually reveals to us. One thing that's revealed is we all have a limited time to live. And what do we want to have present with us and available to us on our deathbeds? It's probably not our possessions, our identities, our roles, or our achievements. These all might be very worthy, but they will not sustain us in these most critical, challenging moments of our life. It is probably our capacity to abide with a mind that is a friend, with kindness, compassion, understanding, and equanimity that will truly be our allies. When we look at what investigation has revealed to us, that the fleeting nature of all moments, the fragile nature of all moments, the fluidity of all moments. And the Buddha says, if we really understand this, there arises this deep passion, this deep enthusiasm about walking the path and awakening. I think so. I might have shared this with some of you that quite some time ago, I was invited to a friend's 70th birthday party. And it was an unusual birthday party, I would say, because we were all invited into a room and presented with a piece of slate and a piece of chalk and invited to write our own tombstones, our own headstones, which, again, I thought was a rather novel birthday party idea, but it was also revealing what people wrote. Nobody wanted to write, you know, like, you know, I've got $100,000 in the bank, you know, or, you know, I really cracked my career, you know. It was a moment of reflection about what do we most deeply value? What do we most deeply cherish? So let's look at some of the aspects of virya, beginning, I think, with this aspect of courage or fearlessness. Here, we are not talking about dramatic acts or grand gestures, but I think much more about sustained commitment. When I lived in the Tibetan community as a teenager amongst people who had truly lost so much, but whose hearts were intact, I saw this quality of virya embodied so frequently. And there was one elderly monk who'd endured years of imprisonment and deprivation and harshness. And Dalai Lama said to him, what were your times of greatest danger? And this monk answered that the time of greatest danger was when I was in danger of losing compassion from my jailers. And I thought, this is what virya is really all about. That capacity to sustain commitment, that commitment to compassion in the most devastating circumstances. And what kind of heart really knows this? I think virya does have something, and it's particularly, I think, relevant to us in these times that we live in. Virya has something to do with our willingness to bear discomfort. The willingness to bear discomfort, to have the confidence to stand in the midst of the difficult, what might feel initially to be unbearable, and not resort to familiar mechanisms of flight, avoidance, or agitation. To be able to forbear or bear with and find an appropriate response. I think in these times that we live in, this is one of our greatest friends, one of our greatest allies, one of our greatest strengths. This is what brings resilience to the heart, the capacity to bear with that which is difficult rather than the mind, which is leaning forward and thinking, when this is over, you know, when this is over, I will have a life to live. When this is over, I will be happy. I learned my young 5-year-old grandson lived with us during the lockdown for 2.5 months, and he was quite a constant source of inspiration for me. And every day, of course, because our movements were so limited, we would do pretty much the same thing day after day, and we would go to the field. And one day we were on our way to the field to get some exercise, and he said, "Amma," he says, "we do the same thing every day." And I began to apologize, you know, and to explain and say, "I'm sorry." And he says, "But Amma," he says, "I'm not complaining. I don't mind." He says, "I have everything I need." I thought, ah, he has everything he needs. He has everything he needs. He has people around him who care for him. And I know this is not true for everyone. But that sense of being able to forbear with difficult circumstances, and yet still that the spark of joy is possible. Traveling this path, we will all meet moments of struggle, moments of despair. And I think sometimes that the discomfort of encountering some of our most deeply embedded patterns, we meet dukkha. You know, Joseph Goldstein once described meditation as the opportunity to experience one insult after another. You know, we meet our most deeply embedded patterns, and we meet dukkha, and again, it is a crossroads. We can think of, you know, a better moment, or we can resort to the mechanisms of avoidance which really don't work well for us. I hate this. I want this to be over. The agitation, the worry, the fantasies of the better moments. Aren't these all those bailing patterns we talked about yesterday really kicking in? Really kicking in so clearly. Or we numb out. We numb out. Or doubt. Perhaps I'm not up to the task. Or we can draw upon virya. This capacity that each of us has to turn towards the difficult rather than to turn away, to be steadfast in our commitment to understanding. I think it's so helpful to acknowledge the link between intention and energy, and to acknowledge the link between interest and attention and energy. When there is that interest possible, it brings energy with it. It brings curiosity. Investigation, as we talked about it yesterday, really takes us beneath the surface of our views and our ideas. And we may well discover, I'm not the kind of person I believed myself to be. Another person, another human being, may not be the kind of person we thought they were. And part of courage lies in that willingness to be surprised. Virya is about being dedicated to our skillful intentions, the intentions that we have to live as ethical, responsive, engaged human beings in the midst of joy and sorrow, pleasure and pain. And that is not easy. You may well have noticed how deeply infectious aversion is, and how deeply infectious fear is. And that when we're in the midst of situations, you know, when a lot of aversion or fear is being articulated in speech, how challenging it is to stand committed to our own intentions of ethics and compassion and kindness. And this is, again, that radical shift inwardly, where we learn to give greater authority to our intentions and understandings rather than the predominant mind state or emotion of the moment. It's our continued willingness to show up for our life, however it is just now. And this is really not about how we feel about what something. It's about how we wish to live our lives. So Virya, I think, raises questions on so many levels. You know, when I say developing that capacity to give more authority to our deepest intentions than our predominant mood or emotion, I think this is quite countercultural. You know, we talk about the authenticity of our emotion or the authenticity of our mood over what is our intention. You know, if I feel really angry, you know, that's authentic in the moment, and I will, you know, do whatever I do with all that rage. Or we commit to our intentions of kindness. It's really swimming against the tide. It's the Buddha, in the Buddhist teaching, you know, what we feel about something is certainly to be acknowledged and to be respected and to be honored, but not necessarily to be the guiding force in our actions and our speech and our choices. And I know that is uncomfortable for many people. You know, they feel that somehow they're betraying their emotions. I don't think so. I don't think so. I think investigation really is showing to us over and over again what leads to affliction and what leads to the end of affliction. What leads to freedom rather than being captured by the loudest voice in the moment. The Virya, as the Buddha put it, is truly swimming against the tide. It's swimming against the tide of impulses. It's swimming against the tide of compulsions and habitual patterns. And it's swimming against the tide of those five veiling factors that we spoke about yesterday. Swimming against the tide of craving, of ill will, of agitation, of numbness, of doubt. It's also, in a wider level, I think Virya is the courage to sometimes swim against the tide of societal norms that cause distress and suffering. We see Virya in every social, political movement of change that values justice, equality, and freedom. Without Virya in people's hearts, you know, we would never have had the end of so many, you know, structures in our world that cause distress. We see it today. You know, I'm sometimes awed by the Virya of those who are deeply committed to environmental change, the Virya involved in those committed to Black Lives Matter movement. You know, this is so much swimming against the tide. And so, you know, I think we can acknowledge that all profound change outwardly that we've seen and inwardly too rests upon Virya and ask for Virya. There's a quote from the Tibetan tradition that says, "The essence of Virya is finding joy in the undertaking of wholesome and skillful actions, thought, and speech." Virya is really the mental factor in skillful effort or appropriate response. There's one teacher of the past who was asked after decades of practice, you know, what is the most important lesson you have learned in all of your years of practice? And he answered, an appropriate response. What is an appropriate response in the midst of our lives? And in the midst of the five veiling factors to prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome states, to unbind or to release unwholesome states that have arisen, to arouse and bring into being wholesome states that have not yet arisen, and to deepen and sustain and bring to fruition that which is wholesome and liberating. We are cultivating Virya in the midst of our lives and in the midst of all of our moments. I know many people speak to me about their meditation practice, and far less people speak to me about their meditative path, which is a life path, of course, that involves, every aspect where nothing is left out, where everything matters. And Virya is really the raft that we use to navigate our way through this life, which at times is quite difficult. So what I'd like to do this morning is I'd like to, I can go through a couple of these bhujangas, these limbs of awakening, and then take a pause before we have a break for any questions that you have. Understanding that I'm doing a little bit of a bus tour through these qualities, given the amount of time that we have available. So let's reflect on this next of these treasures, this quality of piti, joyfulness. And again, this word in Pali of piti, it's very much a spectrum word. Again, it has nuances of enthusiastic interest. Sometimes it has nuances of rapture, of happiness. It really speaks of the capacity of our hearts to be uplifted and gladdened. It also holds the seeds of a gentle, appreciative joyfulness, celebration, and contentment. On this path, it is possible for us to approach this path with a truly exaggerated over earnestness. We are in the serious business of waking up, it doesn't always help us. We can have this feeling like that there is so much dukkha, the path is so long, the realization impossible, and our hearts begin to sink. Without joyfulness, one of our great allies, without joyfulness, we will find it really difficult to sustain our interest, our intentions, and our efforts. Certainly I probably, like many of you, I have practiced in meditative traditions where joyfulness seemed to be almost forbidden. To have a smile was like you're not taking this seriously. And what I found in my own experiences is truly just that, how really challenging and difficult it is to sustain interest and commitment and intention without joyfulness. This is not really an optional extra. It's curious to see how many of the lists in the Buddhist tradition joyfulness features. It's not an optional extra or a reward. It is a quality to be woven into all of our efforts to cultivate the bhujangas. It's learning to carry a smile in our hearts, which is not about superficiality. It's not about pretending. The Buddha put it that this is a path of happiness that leads to the highest happiness. And the highest happiness is peace, nibbana, or liberation. When piti, this word piti, is translated as rapture, this is a quality of piti that is usually associated with deep meditative states of absorption, when mind and body are still in a collectedness whose nature is rapture. But piti is also an abiding, the quality in which our hearts, our minds can make their home. In the Dhammapada, one of the early much loved texts in the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha encourages us, abide in happiness, free from hostility, amongst those who are hostile. Abide in joyfulness, free from distress, even amongst those who are miserable. Abide in happiness, free from busyness, amongst those who are busy. Joyfully we live, those who cling to nothing. Joyfully we live, those who cling to nothing. I think the most important message held within this teaching is the Buddha pointing to the reality that happiness and joyfulness are not dependent upon having ideal or perfect conditions in our lives. If we truly embrace that understanding, it frees us from so much agitation and busyness, doesn't it? The level of energy, the level of effort and busyness that we can put into trying to rearrange endlessly the conditions in our lives to make them more ideal, more perfect, so that we can be happy. That life of busyness, I think, is one that can have no end. So the Buddha speaks of joyfulness in two ways. He speaks about sensual joyfulness and about non-sensual joyfulness. I think the more accurate translation is fleshly and non-fleshly joyfulness. There is much in life that gladdens our hearts, that brings a smile in nature, in art, in music, in poetry, in relationship, in caring relationships. And none of this is something to be sneered at, but to be appreciated and celebrated. Because within this, we have a taste, just a taste of our capacity for gladness, to be uplifted, for the mind to be brightened. Some of you, I know, have some familiarity with contemporary mindfulness teachings and 8-week programs, and how it, for example, in the MBCT 8-week program, one of the weeks is dedicated to noticing pleasant events. Just to noticing and appreciating pleasant events on a daily basis. And it's not in any way an attempt to deny the depression or low mood that many people are living with, but it is an endeavor to begin to rebalance this negative attentional bias and teach us something about coexistence. Yes, it can be that which is difficult on every level just now. And yet there is that which is lovely, that can be appreciated. Culturally, I do get a sense that too many people live with a joyfulness deficit. You know, a sense of depletion, a sense of happiness, a heaviness, a sense of being burdened. And we really need to see what that does to us, how it increases the sort of negative attentional bias, where what seems to fill our consciousness is everything that is broken and imperfect, and how that leeches joyfulness from our lives. Not everyone feels that trusting about joyfulness as a pathway to be cultivated. You know, when it may feel to be somewhat frivolous when there is just so much distress and loss and suffering in the world, we may not believe that we're actually worthy of joyfulness, or that happiness is going to be some future reward born of suffering. We might believe there is something more noble in suffering than in joyfulness. We might believe that happiness is only possible through sustained contact with pleasant sensations and events. I think it's so important to remember the ways in which joyfulness resources us inwardly. It resources our capacity for compassion and to be present in the face of suffering without becoming burnt out and exhausted. Joyfulness is the indispensable companion of compassion, and it is what allows the mind to be a friend and a place of refuge. I know during these last difficult months for many people who've been working in frontline services, you know, the levels of fatigue, the levels of demand placed upon them have been truly exhausting. And, you know, some people speak about, you know, well, many people speak about burnout and compassion fatigue. And I do sometimes feel that many of you may be on the front lines of dukkha, either in your own families or in your work. And here it is especially important not to neglect joyfulness. We do so at our peril, because this is what renews us inwardly, resources us, inspires us, brings energy, brings a sense of being able to begin anew and to see anew, rather than becoming increasingly burdened and contracted. Sometimes it's just that we can't make ourselves joyful, but we can certainly learn to make room for joyfulness. Sometimes it is something so simple as just connecting with that which is lovely, that which gladdens our hearts, whether through nature or through music or through art, that which actually brings a smile to the heart and reminds us of that possibility in the midst of the difficult. Non-sensual joyfulness points to a joyfulness that is inwardly generated. It's a powerful quality and potentiality that has such a profound and deep effect on uprooting craving. It has such a deep impact in uprooting the inner deficit culture that leads us to look at the world with hungry eyes, needing, wanting to be enlivened, wanting to be gratified, wanting to be consoled, wanting to be comforted. There's an ethical dimension to joyfulness. As we give up the pursuit of craving and the insistence that the world and other people make us happy, how would you be in your life if someone came to you and looked you in the eyes and said, "Make me happy"? You would probably feel like this is not really within your power. And yet how easily on a daily basis we can almost look at the world and other people with the eyes that say, "Make me happy." So there's an ethical dimension in developing this understanding and touching upon this inwardly generated joyfulness that really calms and stills those powerful impulses of craving and needing and wanting and demanding and consuming. It allows us to step out of the agitation, again, of pursuing the world of ideal conditions. There's a wonderful teaching from a Chinese tradition. It says, if you keep a green branch alive in your heart, the singing bird will come. And I think the green branch alive in our heart is born of mindfulness. It's born of investigation. It's born of our capacity to be here wholeheartedly, to see, to listen, to touch wholeheartedly. And in this, to be touched, to see anew. Joyfulness is an interesting quality because It is certainly one of the outcomes of a calm and collected mind, but it's also the forerunner of a calm and collected mind. I don't know what your experiences and practice is, but have you noticed how difficult it is to really gather your attention when the mind is either filled with distractions or it's lost in ruminations or obsessions or preoccupations? It is just so difficult to find any sense of collectedness. So in many ways, the Buddha suggests that we actually need to cultivate the conditions inwardly for that deep inner collectedness. That it's not just a product of meditation or an outcome of meditation, but is actually the condition for deepening in collectedness. You see, the Buddha said, in a mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation. Joyfulness is also the nature of deeply collected and unified hearts. So we learn. I think it's a real pathway, it's a real learning to make space and to make room for joyfulness and to cultivate our capacity for gladness. And it doesn't depend on the absence of the difficult, but in the midst of the difficult. Learning about coexistence is a profound learning. We see how prone we are to seize upon fragments of experience and to mistake them to be the whole. You know, there's a pain in the body and how the attention just contracts around that pain until it fills the whole field of our awareness. You know, or there's a difficult thought that arises and how our attention contracts around that fragment of our experience until it fills the whole of our consciousness. How we can meet someone in our life and focus upon something in them that we find very difficult or vexing or annoying, and it becomes the whole of that person. And learning the pathways of coexistence is learning not to seize upon fragments of experience and mistake them to be the whole. Yes, that my shoulder might be aching, the palm of my hand is just doing quite fine. You know, yes, there's a pain in my life or a loss, and still the birds are singing and the sunlight's on the trees. That yes, that person may have a very, very vexing tendency in themselves, but look, maybe they're doing their best, you know, or this is something I can appreciate in them. Joy and sorrow do not exclude each other. They live side by side. The Buddha speaks about appreciating the joyfulness of ethics, the taste of generosity, the taste of kindness. Simply that we continue to breathe and live, we might see celebrate the changes that we see within ourselves. The falling away of the unskillful and unwholesome. We might appreciate growing capacities for forgiveness, for care, for simplifying and appreciating. We might appreciate the spaciousness, joyfulness, and freedom found in every moment that we put down our arguments with the unarguables. The arguments that tell us that change is unfair, that dukkha shouldn't be happening, and we don't always get the self that we crave. There is such happiness, joyfulness in putting down those arguments. Again, from the Chinese tradition, there's a wonderful teaching that says, you cannot prevent the birds of the air from flying over your head. You need not let them nest in your hair. We can't hold back, you know, the tides of life. We can't determine what comes our way. But we can choose not to allow the birds in the air to nest in our hair. Okay, I think that that's actually quite a good moment to pause, and to create some space. If you have any questions or reflections about what we've covered so far in your morning, again, the option is to use the raised hand feature. And if you're willing, then when we call upon you to unmute yourself, because it really is wonderful to hear people's voices other than mine. But if for some reason you feel shy about doing that, you can always put a question in chat. And yes, Brian has just put that in chat himself. And please don't be shy.
Christina, we have a question that came in late yesterday.
It
Should we
didn't
start with
appear in
that?
my chat, Brian. I don't know why.
Pardon me?
It didn't appear in my chat.
No, it wasn't sent to you. That's why I didn't see it. But the question was, I believe, from Patrice, which asked you to explore the chains of emotional history and memory, which I believe is a phrase you use.
The chains of emotional history and memory.
I guess that's a phrase that you used yesterday.
I said that one of the functions of mindfulness was to sever the link that seems so automatic between perception and emotional history and association. That this is one of the functions. There's Patrice. Okay, I see you, Patrice. That this is one of the functions of mindfulness. It's recognizing that perception is following the same pathways in the brain as memory. So we see something and we don't see things anew very rarely. We see things as we've seen them in the past. And this is, in the most extreme case, you think of PTSD, how a single sound, for example, or a single sight can re-trigger a whole storm of emotion and difficulty that's been associated with that sound or that sight in the past. And of course, this is functioning through our lives. It's why we have so many preferences, seemingly preformed preferences of preferences and likes and dislikes. We see something, no, I don't like that. Or I really like that. I really want that. Or this is beautiful. Oh no, that's really ugly. So what we see is that we don't just almost perceive the past over and over again. We also, in that perception that's tied into memory, we're experiencing and re-experiencing the same reactivity that was there in the first encounter or the first meeting, So one of the powerful jobs of mindfulness is to begin to sever that link, the sight in the sight, the thought in the thought, the body in the body. Really, as a training, beginning to sever that link, so that actually it's almost a question, almost a quality or a pathway of re-perceiving. So it's not about trying to somehow eliminate perception, which would really be unhelpful for us, but developing this capacity for re-perceiving, and investigation helps a lot in this. A lot in this. Perhaps it's not as I assume it to be. The way that mindfulness is working, that you have, say, a difficult memory or a difficult perception arising, you feel the associated reaction or emotion arising with it. Rather than running with that reaction or that emotion, you're turning towards it, bringing an element of kindness, compassion, curiosity towards the emotion and towards the perception, and enabling yourself to form a different relationship in the moment. form a different relationship of the in the moment, rather than one that is just automatically triggered in the absence of mindfulness.
Thank you. Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you.
And Philip, we have a question from Philip.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Philip. There you are.
So thank you very much. It's been a great symposium. I appreciate that. Identification with the sense of self is probably the critical component in liberation and mindfulness. Impermanence has never been something that I can appreciate. I'm one of those people who say, my God, I'm losing it. That doesn't make me happy. It makes me sad. So I wondered if you could outline some strategies independent of impermanence that allows us to disidentify with the sense of self.
It's a big question, Phil, but I'll do my best. I mean, first of all, from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, self is not a noun, it's a verb. There is a process of selfing. So your sense of self in any moment, the sense of self that you end up with, has been shaped. It's a kind of the outcome of a process. It's been shaped by fears, by anxieties, by the veiling factors. It's being shaped by clinging. Now, you will notice in the presence of, you know, really lovely qualities, for example, in the presence of generosity, kindness, compassion, spaciousness, peacefulness, you probably notice that the voice of selfing is much quieter. You probably notice that the voice of selfing goes up in volume in relationship to the difficult qualities. Yeah? I'm sad, I'm anxious, I'm, you know, hateful, I'm a failure, whatever. It tends to go up in volume in relationship to the difficult qualities. So from the perspective of Buddhist psychology in terms of process, you know, there is craving and aversion, you know, wanting and not wanting, liking and not liking. Sometimes this is just a little passing wave, you know, it's no big deal. Sometimes it's much more intense, you know, I want, I need, I don't like this, I hate this, I can't bear this. When craving and aversion intensifies, and this is actually good to check out in your experience, you can feel consciousness beginning to contract around it. You know, I don't see anything outside hardly of what I'm really zoomed in on in terms of what I want or what I want to get rid of. You can feel consciousness contracting as craving and aversion intensifies. That contracting is the process of clinging. You know, it's like closing your fist around something. You know, if you hold a sharp pebble in an open hand, it doesn't hurt. If you clench your fist around it, it begins to hurt a great deal. So craving and clinging intensifies, and there's this process of contracting around the craving and aversion. That process of contracting is the process of clinging. Now, when clinging intensifies, it's like it shoots out a view of self. You know? I am defined by what I have identified with. I am defined and described by what I have clung to. This is who I am. So I think in terms of beginning to sort of loosen this process, you know, we start wherever we can to become really interested in those impulses of craving and aversion. Can I surround them not with contractedness, but with curiosity and with carefulness? If we can do that, there's a very real possibility in acknowledging them that they actually won't, that the fist won't close. But we may come to clinging and find ourselves already in the midst of identification and clinging. The process can happen so quickly, reliant upon how much mindfulness is present. And then it's not too late. You know, you begin to actually notice and to become familiar with the landscape of clinging identification. What is it like in the body? You know, what's happening in the body when that's going on? What's happening in the mind? How do I know identification? Yeah. How do I understand it? So it's never too late to bring that sense of curiosity. Or maybe you actually get to that place where a view of self is fully formed and feels like concrete, you know. I am just a failure, you know, I am just a disaster. Notice it's still not too late. You know, turn it around, am I? Ask the question, am I? Am I a disaster? Am I just an anxious type? So it's never too late, but investigation and kindness and curiosity is just so important in this. And remembering we're not endeavoring to get into a place of no self. You know, I think this is really such a sort of hiccup for many people in the practice. You know, the selfing is seen to be this sort of, you know, great spiritual crime, and the idea that I should get to a place of no self. The Buddha never speaks about no self. In fact, he said, if you were to choose between a view of no self or a view of a permanent self, you should go for the view of permanent self, because the view of no self holds no ethical accountability or responsibility. So we're not trying to get to a place of no self. In your life, you know, you will always have a navigational self. It's not an issue. Yeah, I get up in the morning and I know what address I'm at. You know, I know which car is mine. You know, I know who my family is. Fortunately, you know, I know how to get to the supermarket. You know, you're always going to have a navigational self. It's not an issue. So, and it's very important not to highlight self as the critical issue. The critical issue in the Buddha's teaching is not self. The critical issue is dukkha. Where do we suffer? Where are we afflicted? Where do we feel most alienated, most disconnected? Where do we feel ourselves struggling? This is actually the critical issue. And then we start to see, well, actually, views of self really don't lead to many places except affliction. You know, and then we get curious about that. How can that be explored? How can that be understood? I think we need to be so very careful with this particular aspect of the teaching. You know, when I think sometimes people come into the teaching, they hear ideas of no self. Well, if you're coming into the teaching where you come from a history where your sense of self has been suppressed or annihilated or negated by your culture or by people in your life, this is like dangerous territory. You know, like, I don't need more erasure. You know, I don't need more annihilation. We also need to be careful that this becomes, you know, sort of like, you know, like nobody's home, so I can do whatever I want, you know. I shouted at you, well, it wasn't me. You know, so we need to be so careful about this aspect of the teaching, that the Buddha acknowledged we will always have navigational selves. He actually also acknowledged identity. Yeah, the Buddha had an identity. You know, my identities in my life are quite fluid. You know, when I go to the store, I'm not a Dharma teacher. You know, when I'm playing Lego with my grandson, you know, I'm not something else. You know, my identities in life are quite fluid. And the Buddha, in one of the discourses, what is to be cultivated and what is not to be cultivated, the Buddha encourages us to cultivate identities that lead to the deepening and growth of the wholesome and the fading away of the unwholesome, and not to cultivate identities that lead to the deepening and thriving of the unwholesome and the fading away of the wholesome. And that, I personally find this is a really quite an illuminating question, you know. What identities do I inhabit that lead to the deepening of the wholesome? What identities might I inhabit that lead to the deepening of the unwholesome? But it's very clear in this teaching that there's a recognition that it's through identities, you know, that we communicate. It's through identities that we touch the world. You know, it's through identities that we find the means to articulate and to embody what we value and what we aspire to. So, you know, there's nothing in this teaching about becoming a sort of marshmallow, you know, or, you know, a toadstool on a log, but the encouragement to actually, you know, really inhabit identities without clinging. And you can tell if an identity has clinging because it tends to get turned into a view rather than an identity, and it tends not to be fluid. But to cultivate identities that actually really do allow us that creative capacity to communicate and to embody what we feel is really valuable and helpful and leads to the end of affliction. I don't know if I'm talking, I don't know if it's helpful at all, Phil.
Thank you very much. I think the point is exactly what you said, is the point I was trying to make is it's not the presence of self, it's the clinging to
self. Absolutely.
Christina, we have a question from Elizabeth.
Okay, Elizabeth, are you willing to?
And it says, would you be willing to repeat the quote related to abiding in happiness and abiding in joy, and where can it be found?
It's found in the Dhammapada. There's many different translations of the Dhammapada, so you're going to hear it translated in differing ways. But the quote is, the encouragement is, abide in happiness, free from hostility amongst those who are hostile. Abide in joyfulness, free from distress amongst those who are miserable. Abide in happiness, free from busyness amongst those who are busy. Joyfully we live, those who cling to nothing. And there is a section in the Dhammapada on, sometimes it's translated as happiness, sometimes it's translated as joy.
Great, thank you so much, Christina.
Welcome.
And time for another question?
Yes, indeed.
All right. Andre, could you go ahead and unmute yourself?
Yeah, hi, thank you. Really appreciate you taking the time to offer these teachings, Christina. I was wondering if you could go a bit into the discernment between protective awareness and defensive awareness. I heard an anecdote actually from Corrado Pensa about how you were visiting Rome with your father, and he was being really impatient, and you asked him, like, why are you being like this? And he said, like, what do you mean? I've always been like this, you know? And, you know, it's tying into what you said about not letting the birds in the air nest in our hair, and not inviting in visitors that are harmful, acknowledging them, but somehow striking a balance between, you know, wise avoidance and actually engaging our life without trying to, you know, design it so it's perfect. I know it's a big topic, but just...
No, it's a good question. I mean, in my perception, I think, you know, I have seen defensive awareness practiced in many practice situations in the world, you know, like I just... I'm protecting my silence, you know, I'm protecting my space, you know, even on that level, I can't let anything in, you know, I have to guard this and defend this precious thing in case I lose it. So, you know, defensive awareness, for me, it always has a, you know, something of an element of fear in it. It has an element of aversion in it. It's really closing doors to what we think is just simply unbearable to us that we can't embrace. And it's a very contracted space, defensive awareness. Protective awareness, I think, is a completely different creature because it is really protecting the well-being of our hearts, but it's also protecting the well-being of others. And it's very, you know, it really is a question of feast and famine. You know, you think about whatever you feed is going to grow. Whatever you feed is going to return. You know, whatever you feed is going to strengthen, you know. And so that can be a relationship to the wholesome or to the unwholesome. And you think about how we feed the unwholesome, you know, with thought, with reactivity, with fear, with aversion, and it's certainly going to grow. So I think it's a question of fasting. You know, protective awareness is a question of fasting. Yes, the difficult appears, you know, the difficult arises, can be acknowledged and greeted with kindness. And it's like how much attention is actually really needed here. Beyond that acknowledgement with kindness. You know, if I see some, you know, repetitive rumination arising, some dwelling upon some slight from the past, you know, and, you know, carrying it with me and it reappears. Well, I know exactly the way to keep this going, you know, just keep dwelling on it, you know, just keep going through it. And, you know, maybe if I go around that circle, you know, 100 more times, you know, I'm going to come to some liberating insight and it's just going to drop away. Actually, if I go around that circle 100 more times, it's probably going to return 100 more times. You know, I think about sometimes, you know, some of the patterns that are repeat visitors in our life, they're not repeat visitors because we don't know what's going on. They're repeat visitors because we feed them with unwise attention. So protective awareness has something to do with that, just the attention that is needed and not the attention that is making something grow. And, you know, we can sometimes have a kind of really kind of strange, almost addiction to rumination. You know, I mean, if you look at mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, you know, rumination is seen to be problem-solving. You know, if I obsess about something just a little bit more, I'm going to get some kind of magical answer. I think of it like gum chewing. You know, you chew a piece of gum, you know, in the first 5 minutes, it's pretty tasty. What if you had to chew it for 3 days? You know, your jaws would be tired, you know, there's no taste. Like, why don't you just take it out? You know, we could just take it out. So for me, it's a question of really being skillful in what we feed and what we fast, you know, and giving just the attention that is needed to that which is unhelpful. You know, sometimes even problem-solving attention is already implicated in the problem. You know, sometimes the idea that I'm going to work on something, our attention is already, or our view and our attention in that moment is already implicated in the difficult. So, you know, you be a wise gatekeeper in your heart. You know, we learn to be a wise gatekeeper in our minds. You know, yes, this has arisen. Hey, here you are. Here you are. You know, just the attention that is needed. But then it might actually be helpful to stand at the gate and say, you know, this is not a banquet scenario. You know, this is not a banquet scenario. Yeah. Okay, I think it's probably time for a break for a while. So again, Brock, are you willing once more to offer some Qigong and movement for those who would like some guidance in this? Can Brock hear me?
Yes,
you are.
I'm happy to do that. So we'll do some mindful movement, some Qigong, and a little walking.